All right. So I want to read. I want to read 1 Samuel 25 verses 1 through 9, and we'll kind of move through some more verses after 9. But I kind of want to hang out there for the beginning of our time together. So let me do that. It should be up on the screen here in a second. Yeah, I might not have put all of them in there. Last minute decision. I'm trying to follow Travis's lead here. So that's all right. I got it. Verse 1 starts, "Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, so David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, 'Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David.' When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited." So verse 1 of chapter 25, is one of those door hinge verses. And what I mean by that is that the writer is closing one story and he's opening another. With the death of Samuel, the time of the judges has ended officially, because Samuel was the last true judge. He was the link back to that very dark, very violent age. And verse 1 says that when he died, all the tribes came together and they grieved over Samuel, which is good, because Samuel wasn't always appreciated while he was alive. There's a really sad story in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel. This is where the tribal elders come to Samuel and demand a king to rule over them. They want to be like all the other nations around them, even though they could never be like all the nations around them, because their God was not like the gods of all the nations around them. Their God was different. He's holy. He's the God of the gods of the nations around them. He's the God who sits enthroned in the divine council, according to Psalm 82, rendering judgment in the midst of the gods. Israel, despite their best efforts, could never be common. They're holy because their God is holy. And this story in chapter 8 is one of the many, many times that they forget that. So let's read 1 Samuel chapter 8. Verses 1 through 6. It says, "When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations.' But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.'" So, Samuel, you're old and your sons are politicians. They want a king to rule them, and they tell Samuel to go get them one. It's very sad. It's a very sad time. And let me just share a few things that make up Samuel's legacy, okay? Samuel began the work of organizing the Levites into these ministry teams to carry out the work in the Holy Tabernacle. The schedules and the rotations, Samuel started all of that, according to 1 Chronicles 9. Now, David and Solomon continued that work, but initially that was Samuel. And the fundraising for the building of the great temple, Samuel started that, not David. That's in 1 Chronicles 26. And y'all, the writer of Psalm 99 puts Samuel in the same category of great priests as Aaron and Moses. The writer of Hebrews has Samuel in that great ring of honor in chapter 11 right next to David. Samuel was much more honored in his death than in his life. And I guess that's just a story for most great people. And Samuel was a great man. A man God chose to anoint the greatest king in the history of his people. Now, Solomon may have been bigger, faster, stronger than his dad. But the great city of Jerusalem isn't referred to as the city of Solomon. It's the city of David. The star on Israel's national flag to this day is not the Star of Solomon. It's the Star of David. And when Samuel died, David rose, both figuratively as Israel's chosen leader and literally to the wilderness of Paran. And if we read verses 2 and 3 of chapter 25, I think we can pretty much tell what's going to happen in Paran. It's about as predictable as a Hallmark Christmas movie. Let's read those verses. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. Now, names are important in the ancient world. The names the ancient writers used, they could be birth names. A lot of times they are. Or they could be names given to these individuals based on their behavior or their skill sets or their personalities. The name Nabal means fool. So Nabal was an unethical idiot with a lot of money. Maybe he was a politician. Abigail means joy of my father. And my Abigail is very much that. We actually named our Abigail after this Abigail. Lori wanted to name her Elizabeth, and that did become her middle name, but I wasn't really sure about having daughters named Victoria and Elizabeth. You know? We're not exactly British royalty here in Madison County. But the writer of Samuel describes Abigail as discerning and beautiful, just like my Abby. And this odd couple lives in Maon. It's a town in the territory of Judah about 7 or 8 miles south of Hebron. Hebron's a big city. It's just a mile or so south of Carmel, and it's surrounded by wilderness with lots of open pastures for grazing. And Nabal had a lot of animals that needed grazing land. He had 3,000 sheep, he had 1,000 goats. That's a lot of animals. So it sounds like a perfect setup, right? They've got all this pasture land around them for their animals, and when it comes time to sell and trade, you just go about a mile up the road to Carmel. And that's where Nabal is. He's shearing his sheep. Now, this was like harvest time for sheep ranchers. They all come together, they collect their wool, and they celebrate. Just like the farmers do when they harvest their crops in the fall. It's the same idea. There was music and singing. There was feasting. Lots of good wine. It was a really happy, celebratory time. And so David chooses this occasion to make his request of Nabal. And y'all, David really does play this hand as well as he can play it. I'll explain that. You see, David and his guys, they protected Nabal's sheep and his shepherds while they were out grazing. Now keep in mind, we're coming out of the time of the judges, right? Very violent, very chaotic. And Saul at this point is a train wreck, okay? There's no military presence in the hill country where these guys are. The territory of Judah borders the lands of the Philistines. And these raids were common. Philistine raiders would cross the hills into Judah and they would terrorize folks. They'd steal their stuff, they'd assault people, they'd burn their houses, whatever they wanted to do. And David kept Nabal's property and his servants safe, and until now, he hasn't asked for a dime. Because he was actually waiting for harvest, for Nabal to collect his wool, make his money, and then look back on what David had done for him. So David's timing is perfect. Plus, his approach is really good, too, because he does not go see Nabal. Because seeing Big Bad David ride up with a posse might scare Nabal, right? David doesn't want that. He doesn't think he needs to do that. So instead, he sends some of his younger, less intimidating looking guys to see Nabal, and they greet him warmly and with all the kindness that David instructed them to do. And they explained all that they'd done for him, all that they'd done for his servants throughout the year. And they show up on a feast day where generosity was common, if not expected. And they ask Nabal for whatever he wants to give them in return for the protection they provided. No threats were made. No demands were made. They didn't even suggest any type of compensation. They left it all up to Nabal. It's a very reasonable, very friendly petition, and made during a time of high hospitality when people just felt extra generous. And Nabal lives up to the meaning of his name. Look at verse 10. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've killed from my shearers and give it to men who come from I don't know where?" You know, Nabal refusing to reward David and his guys for what they did, that's bad enough. But this great moron just can't help himself. He has to insult David in the process. When he asks, "Who is David?" he knows good and well who David is. Everybody in this country knows who David is. What Nabal's implying is that David, and by association, his guys, mean nothing to him. Nothing. In other words, he's saying, "Who does David think he is asking me for my stuff?" And he's so clueless, he digs the knife in a little deeper. He says, "You know, there's a lot of servants running away from their masters these days." So Nabal says out loud, where people can hear him, that David, the king in waiting, the man who killed the champion Goliath in single combat, Saul's battlefield general and the Philistines' worst nightmare, this David is nothing more than a petulant, disgruntled servant who ran away from home. What an idiot. I mean, of all the people in the world you could make mad at you, you pick David? Nabal's name fits him perfectly. And David responds just the way you'd expect him to. He responds the way I'd expect him to, but probably not the way God wanted him to. You see, David's still being tested. This is the life of a follower. He's still learning and he's growing. Now, granted, he's come a long way, but he's still got a ways to go, just like the rest of us. And Nabal, as dumb as he is, we got to keep in mind, he doesn't say anything about David that Saul didn't say, right? Nothing like that. No threats were made against David, unlike Saul, who's actively hunting David. But yet, one chapter earlier, we looked at last week, David shows Saul so much grace, so much kindness. But here, he fully intends to separate Nabal's head from his neck. Here's the thing. If David is only going to be patient and long-suffering, if he's only going to extend grace and show mercy to folks in authority over him and not people at his same station or under him, he's not ready to be king. Nabal didn't want to pay David for doing something that Nabal never asked him to do. He's not obligated. Now, we can say he's being unreasonable and petty. Okay, that's fine. But Nabal hasn't broken any laws. He hasn't broken any covenants. He's just a jerk. He's a selfish jerk. There's no crime against that. And David wants to round up 400 killers and go wipe them out. Is it because Nabal insulted him? Because if it is, David's got a lot more to learn than we thought. Plus, David obviously does not need 400 helpers to take out one salty old man in his farmhand, right? He has much loftier goals than that. David is going to slaughter everybody. Everybody. So let's compare David's test scores, okay? The previous test in chapter 24, we looked at last week, with Saul at the caves of En-Gedi, David aced that one, right? Totally. Great job, David. Did excellent. But this test with Nabal is a massive fail. Complete dumpster fire. And yet God gives more grace. I love this. In the middle of David's huge overreaction, God does not scold him. He doesn't chastise him. He extends him grace. And her name is Abigail. Look at verse 14. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them." That sounds bad. "Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields, as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know this, and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house. And he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him." Apparently nobody likes Nabal. So one of Nabal's servants tells Abigail what happened. And it makes me wonder if stuff like this happened regularly. You know, Nabal says things he should not say. Folks get mad. Abigail has to swoop in and put out the fire. Because she knows exactly what to do. She gets to cooking and baking cakes. She loads up several donkeys with big grocery bags full of food, and she sends them toward the hills to meet David. But I guess she doesn't think food is enough. She thinks David deserves an apology too, because after she sends her servants with all the food, she saddles up and she follows behind them herself. And it's a good thing she does too, because the writer tells us that David is beyond upset. Look at verse 21. It says, "Now David had said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him.'" Good call, Abigail. Good call. The writer said she was discerning. That shows how discerning she is. And look what she does when she sees David, verse 23. "When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, 'On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant." How's David supposed to ignore that? Abigail is so respectful. She is so well-spoken. She's got casseroles and pies. And she's a looker, too, according to verse 3. David doesn't stand a chance against Abigail. You see how she used that sling analogy? Did y'all catch that? Uses a sling analogy with David. This lady knows what she's doing. This isn't the first time she's had to break through this big wall of testosterone and talk the crazy out of a guy. And it worked flawlessly. This is David's response. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand." So as impressed as David is with Abigail, the human, he recognizes her as a gift of grace. He tells her, "God sent you to me." He understands that. Because if God had not, David and his guys would have showed up at Nabal's farm and they would have killed everybody. And what was his reason for doing that? Because Nabal was mean to him. David has to know that God is not going to honor that. But he's so consumed with rage that he can't process that right now. Just like we've talked about before, David's a hothead. When a man like David acts impulsively, bad things usually happen. Plus, if David had gone through with this revenge plan, how do we think Saul's going to react to that? I mean, David now is the people's champion, right? He's committed no crimes, yet Saul is hunting him anyway. If David does this, well, now he becomes a violent criminal, giving Saul and anybody else the right to hunt him down and kill him. So by sending Abigail, God not only protects Nabal and his household, he protects David from himself. Sometimes we need that. Sometimes we need that. We need God to work through other people to keep us from following through on really bad choices that are going to have really bad outcomes. The grace that David refuses to show Nabal, God shows to him. Because that's what God does. His love for us is not contingent on our love for him or our love for others. He chooses to love us in spite of us. He chose to extend David grace even when David refused to extend grace to someone else. It's a very God thing to do. I mean, I always want grace for myself, but there's a lot of times I want justice for somebody else. They need to pay. Someone wrongs me or cuts me off in traffic or messes up my coffee order, which black coffee is really hard to mess up. You know? It's like, hang them. Burn their house down. But when I'm the guilty party and someone's mad at me, it's like, hey, man, why are you so upset? Why don't you calm down? You know, we do that. We do that. It's just a human thing. Plus, if David had gone through with this master plan, he'd be taking vengeance for himself, which is something David knows good and well he should not do, because vengeance belongs to the Lord. God claims that in Deuteronomy 32. Vengeance is his. He will repay. And David acknowledged that back in En-Gedi with Saul. He said that. But he ignores that here with Nabal. And Abigail helped him see that. Abigail helped him realize that. You know, I want to encourage y'all to finish chapter 25 on your own. I'm going to stop there just for the sake of time. But it ends really well. It's got kind of a happy ending. But last thing before I close. Following Jesus is super hard. It just is. Those people who give their lives to Jesus and their life is rainbows and lollipops the rest of the way, wonderful. I'm happy for them. That has not been my experience. Following Jesus is hard. And like David, there are going to be times where we get things right, like at the caves in En-Gedi with Saul, and there are going to be times like here with Nabal that we get them very, very wrong. But if you know David's story, then you know that God never turns His face away from David. He never abandons His plans for David. David will become king. He will unite the tribes. He will forever be remembered as Israel's greatest king. And even his worst moments, like this one, will not change that. Not because David is special, but because God gives more grace. God gives more grace. It's what Paul means in Romans 5, that where sin increases, grace abounds. David's sin and his moral failures do not disqualify him from God's great love and from God's abounding grace, and neither does yours and neither does mine. And thanks to Abigail, David recognizes his sin. He confessed it. He owns it. And when we do that, grace abounds even more. Because God's grace is greater than our sin. Always. So what works for David works the same way for us. Own it, confess it, repent. It works the same way. This is such a wonderful thing about our God is He's never changed the way He operates or what His expectations are. The way He handles people He loved back then is the way He handles people He loves now. Whether you're a 21st century Jesus follower or you're an Iron Age warrior poet like David, same God. And if your heart is God's heart, you will never outrun His grace, ever. You will never be able to hide from the mercy He wants to give you, and Jesus is never going to turn His face away from you. Those are promises. And this morning, we're going to share communion together. This is a special way that we remember the ultimate grace that we were given. That Jesus, the unique Son of God, He suffered at the hands of sinful, broken humans so that He could save and restore sinful, broken humans. Restore them to what they always should have been. Jesus died to pay our sin debt, just like Travis said earlier, because we could never pay that debt. And God the Father accepted His sacrifice, right? We know that because that grave's empty. Amen, that grave is empty. Jesus is alive. His Spirit is with His people. His Spirit's here. When His people gather, His Spirit's here. So let's give Him the worship that He deserves. And we